Adele's World, number 112. Okay, that was Nobody's Darling and I'll Fly Away. That's a all-girl bluegrass band that's, I don't know if they're really local to here, but they've played here in Traverse City, and they've been on my show before on the real radio. Anyway, this is Mike, and this is Mike Dell's World, number 112. For February 23rd, 2009. More disconnected ramblings from Northern Michigan. Or as my friend Mike James says, a show about nothing. Well, actually, today the show is about something. Got a pretty good response from the audience about my little F-111 story and show number 111. And so I thought I might tell some airplane experiences that I've had over the years. Like I said, I spent better part of a decade in the service of the U.S. Air Force as a aircraft electro-environmental specialist, which basically means if it has air or electricity going to it, I usually had something to do with it. Most of the time I worked on fighter-type aircraft. Of course, I started out with the F-111. But through the years, I also worked on F-15s, F-16s, T-38s. Let's see, what else? A-10, F-117, the stealth fighter. And then, I, of course, also through the years, worked on other types. Mostly helicopters. Of course, I worked on the H-3 Jolly Green Giant, made by Sikorsky. It's a rather large helicopter. And worked on H-60s, worked on an HH-1 Huey. We only had, actually we had two of them, I think, but I'll get to the story about that a little later in the podcast. I also have worked on Dan Quayle's Vice Presidential 707 once. He had a house when he was vice president. He had a house in Destin, Florida, and I was stationed Fort Walton Beach, Florida, at Eglin Air Force Base. And once had the opportunity to work on that. I guess they called it Air Force 2, but it really wasn't. It was one of the VC-137s, which is basically a Boeing 707. And it was just one of the presidential fleet, but it was pretty cool to check out. I worked on the 747 that hauls the shuttle cross-country. One time there at Eglin, like I said, I don't know if I should do it now or... yeah, I guess I could tell it now. But when I was at Eglin Air Force Base in the early 90s, they had to land the shuttle out in California at Edwards Air Force Base. Actually, Muroc Dry Lake. They have this 4-mile-long dry lake runway. Of course, the lake's probably bigger. I don't know why they call it a lake. There hasn't been water there in 100 years. But anyway, they were flying the shuttle, and I don't know which shuttle it was. I should have paid attention. I think it was Endeavor, but I'm not positive. But it had to make an emergency landing at Eglin Air Force Base. I forget what the initial complaint was, but it had something to do with the pressurization. So anyway, they landed at Eglin, which is up in the panhandle of Florida, about probably another 300 miles to go to get to Kennedy Space Center. And they had to change a windshield. Well, on aircraft, especially aircraft that fly at high altitudes, such as airliners and fighters and cargo planes and whatever, the windshields are heated, and so therefore they have a wire going to them. So when they change a windshield, they have to call an electrician out. Well, I've got a lot of transient alert stories, so I'll explain what transient alert is. Each squadron on the base, on a particular base, and this has happened everywhere I've been, takes a week. You know, they rotate weeks on what they call transient alert. And basically what that means is all the aircraft maintenance squadrons on the base, and, you know, most typical bases have at least three. Each fighter squadron or each operational squadron has a maintenance squadron attached to it. And so at Eglin, there was actually 11 maintenance squadrons, but that's a really big base. But every week, they switch off which squadron has a transient alert duty. And basically what that means is any aircraft that comes in that don't belong to one of the squadrons on the base, you know, if something goes wrong and they need maintenance, you're tasked with going to see what you can do anyway. I mean, not always would you have the technical manuals for aircraft that you don't normally work on, but, you know, usually you can go out there and help them out anyway. So anyway, I was on transient alert when the shuttle transporter with the shuttle on top came in to have its windshield changed for whatever reason. And it was kind of cool because on a 747, it was the first time and the last time I ever touched a 747 in the maintenance mode. And this one's a pretty special 747, but it's, you know, standard, I guess, as far as Boeing 747s go for most of its systems, other than, obviously, it's highly modified to haul the shuttle on top. But the way you wire this in, there's a small panel on the outside of the jet, just below and to the side. I guess think this was the left windshield. There's two, actually there's more than that, but two main windshields, or windscreens, as they would say it in aviation parlance. But anyway, this was the left, so it was down below and to the left where you had to wire in the heating elements on the windshield to, you know, for anti-ice and anti-fog and whatever. It's kind of like the thing on your back window of your car, the anti-ice or defrost or whatever it is. It's kind of like that, except for you don't have the lines. It's kind of a strange setup. But anyway, needless to say, it had to be wired in. And the way you did it is they had a maintenance stand that would go up there. And of course, on a 747, it's almost four stories in the air. That was a whole other experience. But they had this great big maintenance stand, and I climbed up there. It's the same one we use to change the taillights on cargo planes. And of course, being an electrician, light bulbs are my deal. But anyway, so I get up there and reading the technical manual that Boeing or NASA or whoever sent to us via fax. Of course, back at that time, this was 1990, I think. Fax machines were, pretty whiz-bang thing. Maybe it was 92. Anyway, I get up there and I wire the thing in, follow the instructions, and of course, somebody in the cockpit testing it out, making sure everything worked and all that. And as I was putting the panel back on it, a realization hit me. I said, you know what? I'm less than 6 feet away from an object that was just in space less than a week ago. And I look up, and there's the shuttle. The nose of the shuttle is just, just barely there. So when we got the maintenance stand, I told the guy that was running the hydraulics on the maintenance stand while I was up there, I said, hey, just swing it over so I can at least just touch the shuttle. And so I have actually touched an operational shuttle. Anyway, geez, there I go. Like I said, I love telling war stories, and like I said, I was kind of amazed at all the feedback I got. So anyway, let's see if I can come up with something else here. So as you know, I was stationed at Mountain Home Air Force Base in Idaho, where most of the F-111A and EF-111A aircraft were. There was somewhere around 48 of each on the base at the time. I got stationed there in early 1985 or late 84. I can't remember which. I think I came home for Christmas and then ended up there in January. But on jet aircraft in general, on fighters especially, the air conditioning systems were run off of what was known as 16th stage bleed air. And basically they had a tap off of the 16th compressor stage of the jet engine, which they would draw off this highly compressed hot air. It was around 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit when it was fully warmed up, and would run it through a turbine. It kind of looked like a turbocharger, and it would rapidly expand this, compressed air, and it would actually get to, like minus 100 degrees Fahrenheit after it went through the expansion side of the turbine. And anyway, then it would take that really, really cold air and really, really hot air and mix it together to make whatever temperature you wanted in the cockpit. And let me back up a little bit. When you're talking about aviation, air conditioning doesn't mean necessarily cooling. Air conditioning means everything from pressurization, heat, cooling, whatever. They don't have air conditioners like you have in your car. There's no know, Freon or R12 or R134 or whatever it is that they put in the automotive air conditioners. It's nothing like that. It's just all air-powered. And, you know, if you rapidly expand air, it cools. If you compress air, it gets really hot. And that's the theories that it works on. But anyway, there was these valves on the F-111 engines called the football valves. And it was just because that was what it was shaped like. They had these big stainless steel tubes and ducts, I mean, like 4 inches around, whatever, that supplied air to the air conditioning pressurization system. Well, we get these newbie pilots in that didn't have a lot of experience with the F-111. They have enough to know how to fly it, but they didn't have enough to know how it acted in cold weather. And when you were on the flight line, when there was, aircraft flying out for a training mission, and that's mostly what we did, was all training missions, and they'd have a launch truck, is what we called it. It was really just a bread truck with a place to play cards in the back where all of us specialists would sit around and play cards until, one of the airplanes called in and said it had a problem on the way out to the runway to take off. Well, during cold weather, these valves, these football valves that supplied air to the air conditioning pressurization system, would not freeze up. The solenoids would freeze up, and they wouldn't open until there was a sufficient heat in the engine bay to unstick them. And it was a fairly typical thing, when it was cold, that these valves would stick, and then, as they were, idling the engines, doing their checks and stuff, the valves would, suddenly thaw out and open. And then they'd get their heat and or air conditioning or whatever they needed. Of course, wintertime, it was, they needed heat, so they're up there cold and no pressurization. Yeah, this is not while they're flying. It's while they're idling, waiting to take off. So anyway, we get some newbie pilots in, and this was my favorite thing to do. I did it at least two or three times. Call what was known as a red ball. Hey, we got a red ball on aircraft 0072. No air conditioning pressurization in the cockpit. So the launch truck could go flying out there and to the spot where the airplane had started up. And usually, like I said, some newbie pilot that has never flown the F-111 in sub-freezing temperature. And anyway, you'd jump out with your headphones on and you'd plug into the intercom system on the airplane and, hey, sir, what's the problem? And he'd explain it and whatever. And so what we would do is we'd get the little ladder and get up near the nose of the airplane. And he'd have the right engine running, and the left engine would be not started yet until they're ready to taxi. And anyway, we'd wait a good, 2, 3, 4 minutes. We'd ask the crew chief, how long has he been running? Because the crew chief knew what we were doing, too. Oh, he's been running about 4 minutes. We'd wait till the 5 to 6 minute range, and then we'd climb up the ladder and put our hand right in front of the canopy and close your eyes, and you'd key up the intercom and go, heel! And you'd let go of the intercom, and usually within 10, 15 seconds of the 5 to 6 minute mark. So sometimes timing wouldn't work out, but at least a couple times it would just all of a sudden start working. And these guys were amazed. They'd come in after the flight and debriefing and, what the heck did you do? It was a lot of fun. Definitely a lot of fun. We did a lot of that kind of stuff around the aircraft. We'd have all kinds of little jokes we'd play, or and the newbie pilots were always fun to mess with. I remember at one time I got a red ball call when I was riding the launch truck, and I get out there, and the pilots, of course, they've been training for so long and, you know, learning systems and learning procedures and learning checklists and all this stuff that they would often read something in the checklist or in the procedures manual and not really comprehend what it meant. And of course, you know, in the military, everything's an acronym. Well, I got called out one time to an aircraft. He didn't have air conditioning. Well, it wasn't cold. It was actually a warm day. And I get on the intercom. I say, "Hey, what's the problem, sir?" And he says, "Well, the air conditioning, we have no airflow to the cockpit in the OFF mode." Okay. You get it? Well, I said, "Well, sir, try the ON mode." And he fiddles around, and sure enough, "Oh, yep, that's it. Thanks." So, you know, it's amazing. You know, these guys that fly these airplanes, you know, they're sometimes mired in procedure and acronyms and all that stuff that sometimes the obvious is not always apparent. And that reminds me of another story. I was stationed at Keflavik Naval Air Station in Iceland. At that time, I was working on the F-15 C and D models, which is the air-to-air fighter version. And in Iceland, it was the 57th Fighter Interceptor Squadron. So we had these big concrete aircraft shelters, and they would launch out and go chase Russian airplanes. Not really chase them. They would escort them through the corridor there on the North Atlantic. So anyway, one time we were doing a war game exercise, and so we were, you know, on alert, and had this, and by the way, these F-15 pilots that were stationed there, since it was a live load every time, I mean, whenever we launched an airplane, there was no real training missions. There was some training missions, but basically, we would launch. That was operational. They had live missiles and, you know, ammo in the gun and the whole works. And, you know, so they didn't bring newbie pilots up to that particular assignment because they didn't want to, you know, be training people. I mean, of course, they had to do proficiency flights and whatever, you know, normal training, but it wasn't like they were training them to fly the F-15. They were all experienced pilots, so it was mostly captains and majors and lieutenant colonels as pilots. And one time during an operational exercise or war games, I was in charge of an aircraft. That was part of my secondary job during wartime, was to be crew chief of an airplane. And of course, I had my own aircraft shelter. It's a big concrete thing out in the rocks there, and one airplane at. Well, every day during alert status, we had to do what was known as hot cocking the airplane. And what that involves is they'd bring the pilot out, and he'd get up in the cockpit and start the engines and, you know, make sure everything works. And, of course, you know, a ground crew would, check this, check that. Well, on the F-15, there's a tail hook, you know, just like, well, actually all Air Force aircraft have tail hooks because of the odd chance that they might have to land on a carrier, which almost never happens. But they also have arresting gear on the actual runways at most air bases in case they have a hydraulic failure in which the brakes wouldn't work and they could catch the wire just like you would on an aircraft carrier. So, you know, all airplanes had that. Well, on an F-15, there was a little panel. You just take a screwdriver and give it a half a turn and this little panel would drop down and there was a release thing. It looked just like something, you know, when you pull start a lawnmower or something, it looked like that, you know, just a little T-handle on a chain, and you give it a jerk, and it would drop the tail hook manually. Well, some other guy had given me this suggestion. I, you know, so we were hot cocking an F-15, and And I told the pilot before he got in, I said, "Hey, I need to test the recoil starter." He looks at me kind of weird. "Recoil starter? Yeah, you know, like a lawnmower. We can start the JFS, which is known as the jet fuel starter. It's basically a really small jet engine that they start first, and then they can start the two big engines off of this little thing." I said, "Yeah, it's got a recoil starter, you know, like a lawnmower, and I need to test that." So I said, "Well, you know, when you get up in the cockpit, just flip the JFS switch to on, but don't start it." And basically, the JFS was started with air. It was like an air bottle, compressed air bottle, and to start it in the airplane, you flip the JFS switch to on, and then you pull this little T-handle in the cockpit that would release the air and get the jet spinning and it'd light off. And it was just, like I said, it's just a little tiny thing. But also, you know, where that T-handle was, it was just a cable. And so you could reach up into this panel and pull the cable and release the air and it would start as long as the switch in the cockpit was on. So I said, "Well, I'm going to try the recoil starter." And he said, "You know, I've never heard of that." And he said, "Well, yeah, there's a recoil starter on the JFS." "Oh, okay." And so he gets up in the cockpit and he flips his switch and he calls me on the intercom, says, "Okay, I got the switch flipped." And he said, "All right, let me give this a tug." Well, I reach up and I grab the cable, release the air into the JFS. The JFS starts and then he goes through all his checks. You know, it's probably a 10-minute ordeal. He gets all done and climbs out of the cockpit and he's looking around underneath the back end of the jet like, "What the hell? I don't know. Where's this recoil starter?" And I said, "Oh, all right, I'll show you." And I popped that little panel down for the tail hook release. I said, "Yeah, right there. You know, if you ever run out, you know, if you don't have an air pressure, you just, you know, you just pop this panel down and pull the cord." "Oh, okay, very good." And I pop it back up, and he goes back to ops, you know, where the pilots hang out. They can't hang with us maintenance guys. And anyway, I get a phone call not 10 minutes later. He goes, "You son of a bitch, I got laughed out of ops." You know, he went on and on. I guess that's one of the older tricks in the book, but he had not heard of it. He was a captain, so he'd been in a while. Anyway. So, alrighty, let's see, what else should I do? I think I'm going to play a little promo here. Of course, Mike James does the Mike Thinks News podcast, and he's mentioned me the last couple times on his show, and we've been kind of back and forth on things. And anyway, notice he had a promo, so let me give his promo a spin here.
MikeThinksNews.com. Hey everyone, Mike James from Mike Thinks News. All the news you need to know in just 30 minutes. I do a show every week on science, technology, culture, the internet, gadgets, and hey, just about anything else I think you'll have a good time with. We always keep it clean. We always have a whole lot of fun. And we always make sure you get all the news you need to know in just 30 minutes. Come check it out, www.MikeThinksNews.com. I can't promise you'll always agree with everything I say, but I do promise you'll always hear exactly what Mike thinks. www.MikeThinksNews.com. All the news you need to know in just 30 minutes.
And that Mike Thinks News show is very informative. He's definitely got an interesting twist on things, and it's really fun when he rants. Hey, Mike, rant more. Anyway, let's see some of the funnier stories. Well, I guess they don't all have to be funny. But let's see. I was after Iceland. I got stationed at a test squadron. And there's only a few of those in the United States. And basically what it was at Eglin Air Force Base, Florida. Of course, where I got to work on the shuttle thing. But anyway, we had various different aircraft, you know, instead of like everywhere else that I'd been, you know, on Mountain Home, there was just two different versions of the F-111. When I was in Iceland, we had F-15s, or the fighters. We had H-3 helicopters, and we had one AWACS, you know, the big 707 with the flying saucer on top. And we had another 707 variant, the KC-135 tanker. But, you know, for the most part, the fighters were all the same. Well, when I got to Eglin, we had, T-38s, F-111s, F-15s, F-16s, F-4s, and, several different versions of each. And then we had, let's see. I'll tell you another story before I tell the story I was thinking of. You've heard of Chuck Yeager, I'm sure. He broke the sound barrier originally. He was the first guy. Actually, he should have been the second guy, but the first guy got in trouble. So he had to fly chase for the first supersonic flight. But anyway, Chuck Yeager at the time was still a rated pilot and for the Air Force. Even though he had retired years ago, and a general retires, he gets to keep some of his ratings, and Yeager ended up being a one-star general. But anyway, I want to say it was the 40th anniversary of him breaking the sound barrier. I'm not sure, but Eglin was the only operational base that still had a few F-4s, and Chuck Yeager was qualified in the F-4. And they wanted to recreate his supersonic flight. Well, you know, most Air Force fighters, other than the F-117, which, by the way, is retired now, makes me feel old because I remember the first one. But anyway, Yeager come down to Eglin for the Eglin Air Show and was going to recreate the first supersonic flight. And, of course, I was on the launch crew for his flight. It was kind of cool. Got to meet him. He's kind of a gruff old bird. But we're sitting out there. We got two launch trucks, basically, like I said, big old Chevy step vans, and, parked side by side on the ramp near where the end of runway is, for the airplanes. And anyway, Yeager comes out, gets out of the crew van, and does his walk around, and he's got another guy with him. Probably a safety pilot, but anyway, I think Yeager was well into his 70s by then. Anyway, so then he proceeds to do his walk around, and then right there in the ramp, pretty much in front of the crowd, although we were quite a ways away from the crowd for the air show, he gets up near the wheel well and whips it out and takes a leak right there on the ramp. We're all sitting there like, oh, geez. Even we wouldn't do that. But anyway, then he climbs up into the F-4, and crew chief pulls the ladder down, and away he went. Did his flight, come back. It was kind of cool. But at Eglin, being that it was a test squadron, we had a few aircraft around just for observation. They were, basically camera planes, camera-equipped, different things. We had some sort of Cessna Citation and some sort of little Beechcraft airliner, and had a couple of UH-1 Hueys. And the Hueys were used at bombing ranges, and what they would do is they would hover near the target. Whoops, had a little glitch there. Oh well. Anyway, these Hueys would hover around the target area at the bombing range, of course, off to one side or the other, and of course, take pictures and video of the resulting explosions and or whatever else. And these were flown by civilian employees of the Air Force, all these observation planes and stuff. The Huey pilots were mostly Vietnam veterans who'd gotten out and then went back to work for DOD for one reason or another. Usually some grizzled old guys, and they were a lot of fun to hang around with. And every once in a while, we'd get to go for a ride in the helicopters, and for whatever reason. And and another detail about the helicopters, they were painted orange and white, or whatever that. They looked exactly like the paint scheme on a Coast Guard helicopter. Kind of orange, white, and black. So they could be seen against the trees and over the water. The Eglin Range, Google it sometime, the Gulf of Mexico Eglin Bombing Range basically takes up a good, quarter of the eastern side of the Gulf of Mexico. Anyway, they had to be able to be seen, because they didn't want to get bombs dropped on them or get ran into by the fighters coming in and dropping bombs or whatever. But anyway, the old Vietnam pilots that would fly these things knew that. And just up the coast from where Eglin Air Force Base is, between Eglin Air Force Base and Pensacola Naval Air Station, there was a nude beach at Navarre, just Navarre Beach. And they'd get done with a mission, and then they'd want to go screw around for a little bit, so they'd go buzz the nude beach. So here's this helicopter. It was a Huey, which isn't normally what the Coast Guard flies, but, to the civilian on the ground, helicopter's a helicopter, and an orange and white helicopter is a Coast Guard helicopter. So they'd go buzz the beach, and then the Coast Guard base would get a call. After a while, they kind of figured it out, and so then we'd get a call after the Coast Guard, or from the Coast Guard commander, saying, "What are you guys doing out there running the beach again?" It was a lot of fun to listen to the stories about it. I never got the call myself. I was never that high up in the pecking order, but anyway. geez, good times, definitely. Okay, one more story. This goes back to when I was still in Idaho. The Air Force, of course, has a similar thing to Navy's Top Gun. Of course, the movie Top Gun with Tom Cruise and whatever takes place at, near San Diego somewhere, I guess. The Air Force has the exact same thing called Fighter Weapons School. It's actually the 57th Fighter Weapons Squadron or Fighter Weapons Wing. I don't remember which, but anyway, that was located in Las Vegas, Nevada at Nellis Air Force Base. And at the time, they had F-15 division, the F-16 division, A-10 division, and I believe A-6s were still used back then. And then they had the F-4s, which were still used back then. And the F-111 division of Fighter Weapons School was actually in Mountain Home, Idaho, where I was. So every once in a while, we had to go down to what was known as checkered flag. You guys have probably all heard of it. Well, at least those who are in the are interested in fighters have probably heard of red flag. And I believe Discovery Channel's done something on the red flag. Well, this was called checkered flag, and it happened once a quarter. It was basically the final exam for these fighter weapons school students. So we'd have to send some airplanes down to Nellis. And of course, the ground crews had to go and all that. And I used to go, I probably went once or twice a year. Twice a year, anyway, for a few years. And one time we were planning on going to checkered flag. down at Nellis. And, of course, it's a busy time because, you know, there's a lot of people in town for that. And so the on-base housing wouldn't be available to us. So, had to get a hotel downtown somewhere. Of course, you know, the Air Force paid for it. So we'd always send, you know, either in this case it was our captain, who was the maintenance officer for our squadron. And we sent him down a couple days in advance to secure us hotel rooms and, you know, hangar space and whatever else we needed. And then we'd fly the planes down and we'd all come down. And I wouldn't fly the planes, although I have flown in F-111. That'd be my last story of this podcast. But anyway, I think I already told that one. Duh. Anyway, that was the Yuma trip. But anyway, we sent this captain down there, and he was supposed to get us hotel rooms. Well, come to find out, he gets down there, and he ended up didn't know who to ask or what to do, and he ended up sleeping in his car overnight. And we all get down there, and of course we don't have any hotel rooms, and the old chief that was with us, he went and took care of it, and we got hotel rooms, and it was no big deal. But I don't know if you remember back in the, I guess this would be the late 80s, their baseball hats they had, and there was one that said shithead on it, and it had a big fake pile of dog crap on the bill. And so anyway, we got a set of captain's bars and put that on there and replaced the captain's hat with this captain shithead. And for as long as I was there, as long as he was there, not to his face, but everybody else always called him Captain Shithead. And that was pretty funny. And also on that same trip, there's all the little generator carts and all the extra equipment that you need to work on the planes is known as AGE, or Aerospace Ground Equipment. Well, they gave us this little tow tug. You know, it was a really small thing, just to pull, you know, little tractor-like thing, to pull this AGE equipment around with. And they forgot to send somebody down there that actually had the license to operate that. You know, in the Air Force, you know, all the equipment, you had to have a license, and then you had endorsements for everything that you could drive legally. It was endorsed on your license. Well, nobody had the endorsement to drive that tow tug except the captain. So we had a captain hauling our ground equipment around for the whole deployment. And towards the end of the deployment, somebody got a license plate off of a, you know, staff car with captain's bars on it. And so on the AGE tractor, we had he had his own staff car, and it was the AGE tractor. So anyway, those of you that have been in the military understand what a staff car is, I guess. So anyway, well, that's about it for the war stories for this podcast. I am going to play another song, and if you don't want to listen to it, it's 3 minutes and 36 seconds, but one that I found appropriate and I haven't heard in a long time. So here's Steve Miller Band, Jet Airliner.
Like
Ironically, the U.S. Air Force is the only operator of any variant of the 707 in the United States, with the exception of John Travolta. John Travolta has an old Qantas Airlines from Australia, a Qantas Airlines 707 that he uses as his own personal aircraft. It must be nice to be that rich. Anyway, it's usually parked down at his house down in Florida. Lives in an aviation fly-in community, and if you search on Google Maps or Google Earth, you can get a pretty good aerial view of John Travolta's house with his 707 parked there. But anyway. That all the rest of the 707s that were in airline service in the United States, at least, were bought by the United States Air Force when they retired, and they're now sitting in the desert outside of Tucson at Davis-Monthan Air Force Base, otherwise known as the Boneyard. And you can also check that out on Google Maps, Google Earth. You'll see just acres and acres and acres of aircraft sitting out in the desert, just waiting for use as spare parts. And there's several variants of the 707 still in service. I believe the last VC-137 or Air Force One version of the 707 has been retired, and I believe that's at the Reagan museum and library out in California, but I'm not positive. There's another one at the Museum of the United States Air Force at Dayton, Ohio, at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. And I highly recommend that you go visit that if you're interested in aircraft. That's the largest collection of military aircraft outside of Davis-Monthan. Would be the Museum of the U.S. Air Force at Dayton. And there's several airplanes in there, I hate to say, were operational and that I had worked on. In fact, all three of the F-111s they have currently on display. Now they have an EF-111, an F-111F, and an F-111A. And all three of those aircraft I worked on. The EF-111 I actually flew with, not on. I flew out commercially, but it flew out to be put into the museum. So once it got on the ground, I was on the ground crew that put it to bed, so to speak. And there's also an F-15 and an F-117 stealth fighter that I've worked on at the museum. So anyway, so go check that out. And yeah, I think their website's pretty good too, as far as looking those aircraft up. But excuse me, got a little frog in my throat. And let's see, I'm gonna bitch about the weather. I gotta bitch about the weather every time I do a podcast, so I'm gonna bitch about it now. We just got done with another blizzard. Can you believe that? I mean, we've had the most ridiculous amount of snow. And yesterday, I was out blowing snow out of the driveway. For those of you in the South, a snowblower is a machine that... I'm just kidding. That reminds me, my dad one time said, well, when I retire, I'm going to throw the snowblower in the back of the pickup and I'm going to just keep driving south until when I pull into a gas station, somebody asks me what it is. Oops, there's the phone. I'll be right back. Okay, I forgot what I was talking about there before I was so rudely interrupted. Anyway, yeah, I think it was the weather. But anyways, out there blowing snow. And, oh, wait a minute. Yeah, did I tell you, finish the deal about my dad? He said he was going to throw the snowblower in the back of his pickup and drive south until when he pulled into a gas station, somebody asked him what that was in the back of the pickup, and then he would know he was far enough south to retire. But anyway, it's out there blowing snow out of the driveway. I get it almost all the way done, and the county road plow comes and decides he's going to widen the road a little bit. So he proceeds to dump another 6 inches of highly packed, sloppy, slushy crap in the end of my driveway. So I ended up spending another 45 minutes doing that, and he knocked my mailbox over. I'll be so glad when winter's over. And well, continuing on the rant thing, those of you that have Apple TV or an Apple computer and you're using Boxy, you'll notice that Hulu no longer works. That just sucks. That's the whole reason I got the Apple TV, was for Hulu. I mean, you know, there's a lot of other cool stuff that it does, and, you know, I'll surely get some use out of it, but what really sucked is Hulu is still on Boxy, but when you go to try to play the video, it pops up and says, you can't play this video here anymore, you can watch full-length episodes on Hulu.com. Yeah. That just ticks me off. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed my war stories and aircraft remembrances. I've got a million of them, I'm sure, but that's okay. I probably shouldn't rant about that too much, or not rant, but shouldn't do that too much. But hey, you know, like I said, got some positive feedback from the last episode, and so I thought, well, what the heck, I'll go through that. And well, anyway, I'll be back to my podcast about nothing next week, or if not before. Like I said, at some point I want to try out the field recording setup now that I've got it pretty much nailed down. And hopefully this wasn't too long. I don't know, I've got 20 minutes since I had the glitch, so I think I had 34 minutes before. So, geez, we don't want to go over an hour if we can help it. So, anyway, this is Mike, and we'll catch you later. That's
all, folks. This podcast is part of the Blueberry Network. You can check out other fine podcasts at blueberry.com. That's Blueberry. Without the ease.
This podcast is produced with Cast Blaster.